Welcome to Leadership Beyond the Trenches. I'm your host, Anne Reifenstein, and today we've got a conversation with Brigadier General Darlene Quinn. General Quinn is Commander Formation Europe and the National Military Representative for Canada to Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe. General Quinn was kind enough to take the time to sit down with me in person, which is so rare now, to be able to share her thoughts about leadership and what it's like to be a leader in her position. So without further ado, here's my conversation with General Quinn. Would you mind just introducing yourself?
Sure. I am Brigadier General Darlene Quinn, the Commander of Formation Europe and Canada's National Military Representative to Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe.
So you've been in the military for quite a long time. How would you describe your role as a leader? And how has it evolved as you've progressed through your career?
Yeah, that is a super question. So, of course, you go from in the beginning, you know, the tactical level of leadership, which, you know, very, very different and very, very specific to the profession that you have, to the occupation that you have. So I was an engineer. And so, you know, very, very hands-on in terms of infrastructure specialists, carpenters, plumbers, electricians, engineers. And now as I progressed up to my career, I think I am exactly what you would call an institutional leader. So no longer is it about the tangible outputs of things, but it's about leading the calf. So, you know, I think of institutional leadership as, you know, taking that one step back. So I no longer lead as, you know, me, the engineer. I no longer lead as me, the Royal Canadian Air Force officer. I lead as a part of the CAF institution. And so I always need to be looking at, you know, what is the best for the institution to move it along. And I see those in two areas. There is the institution itself. So what does the CAF need to look like in the future and how can I contribute to that? So, you know, the basics of, you know, instilling military ethos in people, you know, and setting the conditions for the institution. So, you know, we want to make sure that it's, you know, respectful and inclusive and that people understand those basic military values. So everybody comes into the military with different sets of values. And we, of course, try to give them those military ones, you know, courage and integrity and respect. And then there is the part that is leading the people. And so I guess as an institutional leader, I see my role to produce the next set of leaders. And so for me, again, that's about, making sure that leaders, junior leaders have opportunity. So they have challenging opportunities that helps towards retention as well, making sure that they're going to be part of the institution in the future. But it's also making sure that, you know, they have the continuous learning that is available to them. And then they have leadership opportunities, so ways that they can stretch and grow. And so I think that, you know, my job is to lift them up, to give them mentorship when they need them, and to do otherwise when they need otherwise as well.
So what tools do you use when you're leading an organization like this at the institutional level?
Yeah, so, if I look at, so I have two very different roles here. And so maybe to pull those apart might be helpful. And so the first one that I have is the Commander of Formation Europe. And so that is all of the Canadians who are in NATO roles, as well as the people who support Canadians in NATO roles. And so from that perspective, what we have is we have a distributed network of 10 commanding officers. So I have 9 regional COs. So Europe and the NATO in the US is divided into 9 regions, and then also the commanding officer of the Canadian Forces Support Unit of Europe, who does all of the support for people in Europe. And so the 9 regional commanding officers also have NATO jobs. And so they have 2 full-time jobs. You know, they have their Canadian command and control and their NATO output. So it's a very different setup, I think, than anything that you would see in Canada. Because I think you see distributed leadership in Canada, but usually that distributed leadership is towards the same overall organizational structure. So when I use it in this OutCan experience, I have, you know, we have Canadian officers who are responsible for a NATO output. So they are responsible to deliver for their NATO chain of command. I do not have responsibilities for their output, but I have responsibilities for how they achieve that output. And so how they behave, how they work, how they grow as leaders. And so that distribution is really interesting. But as a result, I have some very senior leaders that are in those roles and very accomplished leaders. And so with the luxury of having senior, talented, experienced leaders, it makes that distributed leadership easier, I would say. And so I've always been one that I want people to understand my intent. So I want you to know what I need you to achieve, so what we are achieving together. And I tend to take a lot of time to explain to people what we're achieving and why we're achieving it. Because I think that if people understand why we're doing something, they don't necessarily all agree with it, but they understand the why and the what, then they can go off and use their own judgment and their own style of leadership for how can they go forward and help achieve that. And so that distributed piece is really about, providing my intent and then empowering them to make decisions. So I don't want to make all of the decisions for everyone, and I don't need to with all that talent. And so it's a case of, okay, how can they tailor their decisions to meet the overall goal? And then the third part of that, of course, is enabling them with resources as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So that's the Canadian side. You talked about your other hat as well, the NMR side. So yes. Could you just discuss a little bit of what you see as your role as a leader, as the National Military Representative?
Yeah, that's it's really interesting because that, again, I think it falls into that bucket of institutional leadership. And at this point, the institution is NATO. And so I am part of what's called the National Military Representative Echelon. So there are 30 NATO countries, 29 other national military representatives that sit around the table. And our job is to inject the national perspective on the individual issues that NATO is working on. So that whether that is enablement, whether that is the looking at the security environment, whether that is new concepts. So I am the Canadian Armed Forces link into Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, which is NATO's strategic command. And so so I don't have any formal leadership responsibilities, obviously, over peers from my other nations, but that's the informal leadership. So that's, you know, the importance of building those relationships and building networks and making sure that you're establishing relationships of trust so that you can work together on issues and that you understand each other's point of view. And that's one of the things I just find fascinating about NATO is, you know, you bring 30 different cultures together, 30 different histories. You know, just the history that my NMR colleagues have it's absolutely incredible. You know, based on the age demographic that we are right now, you know, some of my counterparts joined Soviet forces and served in Soviet forces. Some of my counterparts are in nations that border on Russia or border in the south of NATO, where they see the international terrorist threat is seen differently. So, you know, understanding where they're coming from a cultural point of view and a history point of view, is what helps you build those relationships. And so, again, it's, you know, that institutional leadership where you take a step back. So you understand that, you know, not everything that Canada wants in the form that Canada wants it is necessarily going to go through because it is all about NATO coming together as an institution.
That's really fascinating in terms, because you talk about culture and how that's incorporated into what you're doing. So how do you use culture? Like, how would you evaluate your own cultural intelligence?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You know, sometimes people ask me, does NATO have a culture? You know, because we're really, you know, these 30 cultures coming together. And from my experience over the last couple of years, what I see the NATO culture is really about consensus and compromise. And that's that really speaks to institutional leadership right there, right? Is that the coming together of that. But in terms of the cultural piece, I think there's a couple of aspects. You know, I touched on one of them when I said, you know, understanding people's histories. So for me, it's like there's a basic body of knowledge that's necessary. So in order to have a fruitful conversation where you're not inadvertently offending somebody or just not understanding the words that they're using, I think you have to have a certain knowledge of their history and their culture. And then I think there's also that knowledge of some of the difference in the cultural aspects, you know, whether that is something simple like the concept of time. You know, as Canadians, certainly as Canadian military, we're very focused on be there 10 minutes early to mark your map. You know, and we're very focused on being there on time and backing those timings up. Whereas time in some of the other NATO nations is a more fluid concept. And so, you know, when somebody arrives at a meeting 10 minutes late, it's not intended to be disrespectful. It's just they have that different fluid context of time. So I think you need to understand those things. And then I think there's just the overall awareness that we're all different. You know, we all seem to speak the same language, but we all use words differently. And so just being aware that you might not actually understand. So I'm trying to tell you something, but whether you understand it or not, you have to, you know, you really have to think, did that person get the message that I was trying to convey? And so, you know, that cultural intelligence, I think, while I don't know probably the precise academic definition of it, I think it comes from sort of that buildup of sort of the knowledge and, you know, that the skills of understanding how to deal with the different cultures, and then just the awareness that everybody is different.
It's interesting how you see that from a multinational perspective. What about organizationally? Switching back to the Canadian hat, but you're commanding a very large group. You're at arm's length. Is there an organizational culture within the Canadians that are outcan in Europe or mm-hmm. outcan in general?
Yeah, you know, I think there is. I think, you know, we carry the same culture with us from Canada. You know, we've all sort of grown up in the same leadership schools, the same relatively small band of experiences where, you know, we understand, again, you know, that the basic military ethos in terms of, you know, dedication and loyalty and all of those traits that we want our leaders to have. And we expect them to bring them into these multinational environments. But I also think as Canadians, we tend to develop in a very collaborative way as well. You know, we're used to working with other people and, you know, bringing our ideas, but not necessarily banging people over the head with those ideas. And that's something that's very, very helpful in a NATO environment. Now, that said, you know, the NATO environment organizationally can be very different than the Canadian one. And an appreciation of that is really important to be successful. And if I can give you two examples of two very different organizational and cultural kind of aspects that were very obvious to me when I first arrived here. One has to do with our non-commissioned member cadre. And so as you would know, over the past 20 years, the CAF has taken great effort to develop a really strong professional development program for our non-commissioned members. And, you know, we have extremely talented and well-developed senior leaders who, you know, understand the strategic environment that they're working within and that they're working with their commanding officer in. So that the command team concept became very important in Canada, so that, you know, the chief warrant officer is the commander's primary advisor, and to give that advice, you need to understand that strategic concept. And so we have professionalized our non-commissioned member cadre very, very well. And so, but that is something that is, I would say, very specific to Canada. It's similar in the U.S., but it's not the same across NATO. So when I look at NATO and I see how our NCMs are employed and how they're prepared for that employment, you see a vast difference across the nations. And it doesn't mean any one way is better or worse. It just means that it's different. And so when we have an expectation that we bring a warrant officer or a master warrant officer or a chief warrant officer into NATO and how they're going to be employed, you know, it's not always within a Canadian context. And that's really important to absorb, you know, that some nations don't prepare them in the same manner as we do. And so our NCMs, in fact, our chief warrant officers in particular, are sprinkled across the command and force structure of NATO in an incredibly deep way. We have, I think, 8 senior chief warrant officers across NATO. NATO calls them command senior enlisted leaders, so CSELs, and we have them in some very influential places. You know, I can give you a number of examples. You know, we have the CSEL at LANDCOM in Turkey. We have the CSEL at one of the 3 operational commands, which is in Brunsum. We have the CSEL who is with the NATO SIGS battalion. We have a great number of these, and we find that our CSELs are very, very well appreciated because they're so well trained and they're so attuned to providing that advice to senior leadership. And so, you know, at the they're at the brigade group level, they're at the division level, and now we're actually going to be starting up the CSEL position at the core level, multinational core southeast in Romania. So I think that's really recognition of a couple things. First, how well prepared and how great a job they do. But secondly, how they can assist other nations as role models and sort of show the potential of the NCM cadre to others. So that's one part which I noticed very, very quickly is the difference there. You know, and honestly, the other side in the military environment and shape is gender. It is, again, it's one of those very noticeable differences in Canada and in what I'm noticing in the military aspects of NATO. So if you look at the civilian side of things and you look at the politicians, so if you just take NATO countries, for example, I was curious one day and did a quick Google search, and you'll see that of the 30 NATO nations, 5 of them, 5 of the heads of state are women, which is a pretty, you know, a decent percentage. Then if you look at defense ministers, 7 of them are women. And 2 of those nations have both, at the same time, women defense ministers and heads of state. So, you know, it's not so bad. But if you start to look at the women in senior leadership positions in the military, the situation is much different. And so if I consider NATO headquarters, so if you look at flag officers, and really the body that you could look to is the military representatives to NATO headquarters, so typically a 3-star position, we have 2. That are women. Canada is one, Lieutenant General Allen, and Norway is the 2nd one. And when you look at, again, another NATO organization, SHAPE, so the National Military Representatives, there's myself and there is Norway. So same 2 nations, coincidentally, but still just 2. And frankly, the 4 of us are the first women in these positions. But when I look at Canadian women, who have been working in senior positions, the picture is very different. And, you know, I look at, again, I mentioned General Allen as a military representative. I look at General Whitecross, who recently gave up command of the NATO Defense College, which, you know, prepares senior leaders from many, many nations to do senior NATO jobs and diplomatic jobs. So very, very influential. I look at Major General Carignan, who is currently the commander of the NATO mission in Iraq. Look at Commodore Jose Kurtz, who just recently was the commander of the Standing NATO Maritime Group. You know, I look at my regional COs. You know, one of my regional COs, who's also my deputy, just, you know, happens to be a woman. The CO of CFSUE, Canadian Forces Support Unit Europe, also by coincidence happens to be a woman. My J1 personnel, also a very strong performing woman. My J2, my intelligence advisor, also happens to be a strong performing woman. And I have two of my local CEOs who are also women. This was not a planned thing. This is just, you know, when you pick very good people and strong officers for a job, well, some of them are going to be women. But this is very noticeable in a NATO setting. And so when I first came in and then, you know, my deputy came in, you know, I certainly had other NATO members coming to me saying, wow, you know, your whole office seems to be populated with women. And, you know, my answer to that is, you know, my office is populated with some very talented people, some of which happen to be women. It's a very visible difference. And again, it's a cultural thing. So we as Canadians are very accustomed to having, you know, a mix of gender in all of our work environments. And while we can probably always do better, it's not unusual for us to see women in positions of power. And I think for other NATO nations, it's helpful because some of them have not had women in their militaries for nearly as long as Canada has. And so they haven't been able to rise to those levels yet. And I think seeing women in strong positions and doing very well is helpful to role model. This is what can be. This is the potential of what those militaries can achieve if they want to. So those are two very very visible differences that I see. One is that employment and preparation of our non-commissioned members, and then the other one is the gender integration.
Those are really interesting differences that you've observed between the NATO organization culture and the CAF organizational culture. I'm just going to switch gears now for a moment. I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on the traits required by institutional leaders.
I think that integrity is a huge one. You know, I mentioned it before as something that we expect in our military members. And I think that, you know, leaders need all the way through their career to be able to understand that their integrity is always being watched. It's always being modeled. And people notice. People notice when your actions are inconsistent with your words. And we talk about integrity a lot. And so I think you see, you know, in very senior leaders, you know, with notable exceptions probably, which hit the news sometimes, but the grand majority, integrity, I think, is one of those things that you can really point to. I think also the ability to exercise good judgment, which maybe those things go hand in hand, but, you know, somebody who can take the ball of wool and make a decision that knits the sweater, you know, and your seniors need to depend on you to use that good judgment. And then I would say there has to be a healthy dose of humility in there. You know, none of us have all the answers to anything. You know, your rank does not make you the smartest person in the room. You know, that's that awareness that you can always learn and you should be learning. And, you know, nothing brought that home to me more than being dumped into this NATO environment, as I say, where, you know, all these different security issues and cultural issues and all of those come together. And I realized that I came knowing a lot about Canada, but I didn't come knowing a lot about every other nation and the background. And so the constant learning, and so the understanding that you need to keep pulling from other sources and that will help you be a better leader. I think so. Those are some of the things that we see in great leaders.
So the interesting thing, you say humility. Do you think that's a Canadian thing? Or do you think that's a trait that's universal to institutional leaders? Or do you think that's more of a Canadian trait?
You know, that's interesting because it's hard for me to take my Canadian-ness off and know the answer to that. But and maybe I don't mean humility in a stereotypical Canadian sense. Maybe it's just that, you know, just that awareness, as I say, that you need to keep learning and you don't know everything. And, you know, that comes in line with, you know, respect for other people's points of view and, you know, understanding those before you, you know, carry on and make a decision. Mm-hmm. But that's something interesting I'll have to think about more.
Yeah, just you said that and it really resonated to me. I do expect that humility to be in my Canadian leadership, but maybe those were some of the things when I served with other militaries. I didn't see as evident or as important within those contexts. I don't know. That's one of those things that you can't take your Canadian hat.
It's true.
So it's like,
it is interesting though, because you know, how other nations see rank is also very different. You know, in a Canadian context, I think we're very good at recognizing that contributions can come from, you know, you have a deep experience in something, which doesn't always come with rank, or you have, you know, a deep knowledge in a certain subject, and that is an important, you know, that makes an important contribution. Whereas in other nations and other militaries, rank is much more evident. You know, the person who speaks is the highest ranking person, and it's not culturally acceptable to challenge leadership. And I think we learn as Canadians, there's a way to challenge in a respectful manner, but we welcome challenge because, you know, if you throw an idea out there as a leader and people are sitting back knowing that there's something about it that, you know, could be stronger or is going to fail, and they don't tell you, you know, we consider that to be a failing, right? Because we want to have the best product going forward. It's not the same challenging culture in all nations.
Yeah, and that's evident when you take a look at some of the academic research on culture, national culture, and leadership, and leaders or managers. That power distance, I think they call it, is how how people see that hierarchy and how stiffly it's adhered to.
But if I just go back to you, and then the qualities of the institutional leader. I think the other one, which I had sort of touched on in another answer though, is to build junior leaders. Yeah. You see leaders that are trying to develop the future. So, you know, when I leave the Canadian Armed Forces in however many years that's going to be in, I'm hoping that I am, you know, mentoring and preparing other leaders to take my place and to carry on. And when I look at some of the more leaders who are more junior to me right now, I see greatness, you know, and I'm inspired by what they're going to do. And, you know, I'll be sitting on the sidelines 10 years from now, you know, drinking a cup of tea and watching them going, wow, that is impressive. You know, I knew that person was destined for greatness, but the things that they're achieving, like, I fully expect to be sitting there and having those thoughts.
So what do you think prepares you for this role best? Like, you know, there's role models and professional development and education and experience. What do you think gave you the tools in the toolbox to be an effective or institutional leader?
I think I was very lucky to fill a variety of roles. So I'm a construction engineer by background, and it can be very easy to stay simply within that world. And I did a lot in that world, and I loved that world. I love infrastructure. But I also got to do many things that were outside of my branch. And I think that opened up my eyes to the breadth of what the CAF has. I did some joint jobs, and I did some institutional jobs, and just some very different things. And I think that's important. So the exposure that you get, I got to see a lot of really great leaders. And that's very helpful too. You know, very early in my career, and again, it's still within the engineer family, but very early in my career, I got to be the branch adjutant. And so I got to see very, very close up how the most senior leadership in the engineer branch, how they functioned, how they analyzed, how they came to conclusions. And that was very eye-opening for me. And similarly, you know, I had a role on the strategic joint staff not long after the strategic joint staff was stood up. So to see how decisions are made and how very senior people take all of this information and then what comes out of it and then how they communicate it. So to me, that was very formative. I got exposure to seeing senior decision making, and I had a bunch of really great role models. You know, I firmly believe that everybody is a role model of some kind. Some are role models in the very wow, you know, those are possibilities that I really hope to attain, and they're very inspiring. And some are role models in terms of, okay, this is the way that this person works, and it doesn't work. And so I file that away to, okay, that doesn't work in these circumstances. So, you know, maybe I don't go there. So everybody is a role model in some way.
You talked about mentoring and bringing those as being a key job. So the profession of arms. So one of the roles, you know, as per doctrine, is to the institutional leader is a steward of the profession of arms. I've always had a really hard time pinning that down because that's pretty broad, right?
Yes.
So how do you see yourself in that role, like as a steward? How do you define that?
I would say that it is, you know, I'm entrusted with a role that is a very small role in terms of temporal effect. And so if you think of the history and the future of the Canadian Armed Forces, I have one little slice of it. And so my job is to care for that institution. So to take what's been given to me, to make it better for the future and the others that will come after me. And so, you know, again, I think there's the two components of it. There's the actual improving the institution and, you know, the military ethos and just, you know, the culture. The CAF culture, and then there's the growing those leaders. So that's what I see as stewarding. It is taking what I have and preparing it for the future.
Okay. What's the most satisfying aspect of being a leader?
It has to be by far seeing people achieve something, seeing people in my organization just soar to new heights. You know, We're very blessed with people who have been recognized by their chain of command for a number of different awards in the NATO environment, in the Canadian environment, in many different aspects, the support environment. And I love to see them recognized because I know they're all out there doing good work and they don't do it for the recognition, but when it comes their way, it's wonderful to see. Or, you know, what's very satisfying is to see one of my members go off and be in command and to take command and take that next step. So for me to see, you know, to see the growth of the people in the formation is the most satisfying thing.
So that's, what do you think is the most challenging?
Communication across an entire continent. It's a huge challenge. And so I think I read somewhere that you have to pass the same message three times for it really to sink into people and for them to internalize it. And I would say when you're working across time zones and countries and cultures, it's probably more than three times. And so I have to really concentrate on making the time to communicate and making my messages very clear. And so that's, I think that's my biggest challenge.
What tools do you use to do that?
Much of that is using my subordinate commanders. You know, I meet regularly with them. So the magic of Zoom that has developed over COVID has actually been very handy because we used to have phone conversations. And now we have video conferences where I have all of my COs together. And you know, we talk about the issues. And, you know, again, it's that understand the intent and we talk through things and they're able to bounce ideas off each other. And so I make sure that they understand that. And that's a big part of it. I do periodic town halls, which are open to everybody in the formation or who the formation supports, as well as their families. I reach out through the Military Family Services. So I try to use every venue that's at my disposal to be able to communicate. And again, it is my challenge to make the time to do that.
Speaking of time, I'd like to thank you for making the time to do this with us because it's been a marvelous interview and you've given me so much good stuff to use when I'm talking with people about leadership. So thanks so much.
My pleasure.
I always feel really lucky at the end of these conversations because I've always come away from talking with people, learning something new. And I have to say, there was no exception with having the chance to talk with Brigadier General Darlene Quinn. So I'd just like to say thanks again. And I hope we have a chance to chat again so I can ask more questions about leadership. That's it for this episode of Leadership Beyond the Trenches. Leadership Beyond the Trenches is hosted and produced by Anne Reifenstein. The theme music for this episode was provided by Mikhail Heilman under Creative Commons licensing.